Welcome to Whitley on Wine. My guest today is Rupert Symington of the Symington Port family of premium port wines. That would be Graham's and Dow's and Quinta do Vesuvio. And we're going to chat a little bit about the table wines that are coming out of the Douro Valley. Rupert, the Douro Valley is most famous for port, obviously, but you've been making table wines there for years and years and years. It seems to me, though, that all of a sudden the public is becoming aware of them, and there seems to be a push coming out of the Douro and out of Portugal for the table wines. What's the backstory on that?
Well, I think there's two things here. One is that the public is trying to search out regions of the world where you have interesting wines. I think the public is getting a bit bored of the standard Cabernet and Chardonnay, and they're looking for places where they can find really interesting wines with a bit more authenticity and a sense of place. As producers of port for over 200 years in the Douro, we have gradually acquired over time more land. And as we're planting that land more efficiently, that land is producing rather more grapes than we can than we need for our port business. So really we're trying to find a way capturing, making new wines out of the region. And the obvious thing is to make dry reds.
You know, one of the remarkable aspects of the Douro Valley, and when I go there to taste ports and visit, is the remarkable terrain. And I know that that contributes substantially to the structure of the wines and the quality of this fortified wine that we call port. What does it do for a table wine?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, we have a combination of very, very low rainfall. And when you deny a vine water, it tends to produce much less fruit. So we have quite low yields, two or three bunches of grapes per vine. And that's compared to maybe 10 bunches up in the Napa Valley.
Yeah, and you know, up in the Napa Valley, when they talk about hillside vineyards, it's nothing like the Douro.
And then we have these incredibly steep slopes where originally some 200 years ago, Spanish laborers from Galicia were brought in to build literally hundreds of miles of these stone wall terraces. These steep slopes were not planted with anything. The only things that people could find to grow there were olive trees and vines. And both olive trees and vines needed a little bit of a base. So they'd basically make a dry stone wall, fill it in with earth, and then plant a vine or an olive tree on that terrace.
But, you know, it's arid and it's dry. You do have those steep slopes. You don't have rich soils, and the vines show that they have a lot of minerality. But it's always been my impression that when vines are young, they need a little bit of water at least to prosper and to thrive and really get their roots in before you can kind of start really stressing them and denying them. So 200 years ago, or however long ago it was, when the first vines went into the Douro, how were they nourished?
Well, I think back then, literally, that you had people would literally go down to the river and bring up wine in goat skins across their backs, and they would put a vine in. I mean, this was literally a necessity to grow anything on the land. The region had very poor communications with the coast, with the major populations of Portugal, and this area was largely self-sufficient. So they grew oranges, they raised livestock, pigs and chickens, and each farm had fruit trees. And there was this great process of drying and curing that went on during the year to make sure there was food to last through the winter. But the cash crop was definitely wine. And this meant that, you know, the young vineyard had to be nurtured. They would plant a young vine, water it probably for the first two or three years of its life. But vines in the Douro are very unusual. They have to go about 20 feet underground to find water. The rainfall in the Douro is very, very little. Most of it falls in the winter time, and the water percolates through the very well-drained surface soil and accumulates in the granite about 20 feet down. So the vines have to go down very deep to find water. So when a vine is young, in the first 3 years, you have to help it. Otherwise, it simply won't survive. Every year, we lose about 2 or 3% of our vines to dehydration. It is probably one of the driest vineyard areas in the world. And we're not allowed to irrigate for port, which is curious. I mean, we have to let the vines be very, very stressed. But this is the trade-off between having a big production is you get very, very high quality.
Yeah. So what are the table wines like? I mean, people think of the Douro, they know port, but they may not know the table wines, and they may not be familiar with the grape varieties. So what are the grape varieties, and what sort of wine do they produce?
Well, we have five grape varieties that we've selected in the Douro as being, you know, recommended or better ones. The names probably won't mean a lot to your listeners, but I'll go through them. It's Torriga Nacional, it's Torriga Franca, Tinta Barroca, Tinta Caung, and Tinta Rarige.
Which everybody knows as Tempranillo.
Tempranillo, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I like to say that these vines were originally brought to the Douro by the Romans about the time that they occupied, after defeating Hannibal, they took over the Iberian Peninsula and subjugated the tribes of Iberia, who were pretty fierce. But the Romans, wherever they went, they took vines with them. And the vines that we know in the Douro today, I think, are hybrids. The DNA is indiscernible, as, you know, it's not related to something like Cabernet or Pinot Noir. But these are varietals that have really become hybridized, and they have one thing in common, that they're very drought resistant. As I mentioned, the rainfall is minimal, so these vines have developed in such a way, with very small berries, very thick skin berries, to protect themselves against dehydration. Our summer temperatures go up to about 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and it takes a pretty hardy vine to survive that kind of heat. Mm-hmm. But our vines are capable of that.
Well, you know, many people around the world may not realize it, but the Napa Valley gets that warm in the summer, you know, but it's not as dry.
Yeah, the Napa Valley has advantages. There's a lot of groundwater. There's a river, you know, or we have a river as well, but the Napa Valley is relatively flat, mm-hmm. and there's groundwater. In the Douro, the river flows by, but there's about a 400-meter or 1,200-foot difference between the upper vineyards and the river, and the vines simply can't, you know, take advantage of the river to that extent.
You mentioned those five grape varieties. Are most of the table wines that are coming out of the Douro now a blend of those five, a blend of a couple that you consider the more noble grapes, or is there one grape that you would consider the dominant grape in the table wines?
I think there's been a lot of experimentation over the years. I think table wines from the Douro are a fairly recent thing. I think only in the last 10 years have producers been taking these grapes seriously. As port has become, you know, as the vineyards are producing more than they need for port, and port has become more difficult to sell in some ways, we've done a lot of research into how to make great table wine. We've identified two varietals as our favorite. Torriga Nacional provides good acidity, which is something that's quite hard to come by in such a hot region. And also the Torriga Franca, that's our favorite all-around grape. It has a beautiful kind of violety aroma. It has great structure. And if you use a careful combination of Torriga Nacional and Torriga Franca, you get a very, very balanced and an interesting wine. We have tried making pure varietal wines, but they haven't been as successful mm-hmm. To date as the blends.
Is that partly, though, because it's difficult to find vineyards that are one varietal? They're mostly field blends of these five grape varieties?
I think as producers, we now have more than enough single varietal blocks. We started a program about 30 years ago. As we replanted with these five varietals. And that's meant that we've got, you know, almost 20, 30-year-old plantings of single varietal blocks. So it's not that we don't have enough to be able to do pure varietals. It's more that we're great believers, as with port, the table wines are more interesting if they're blended. Mm-hmm. And we're even going as far as, for instance, our new Vesuvio wine, dry red from Quinta de Vesuvio. This wine has about 60% Torriga Nacional. It has about 30% Torriga Franca. And then we've added just a 10% of something called Tinta Amarella, which is not one of the top five, but it just lends a little bit of interest factor to the,
sure.
the wine.
Well, you know, I think one thing that the American consumer might be able to identify with a little more closely than the grape varieties, you have a definite hierarchy depending upon the Quinta, where it's positioned in the valley, and the grapes that you use for it. Not so much the grape varieties, but the vineyard that it comes from. And so you started out with basically your $11 wine from Dow's. And then we went up to wines that cost as much as $75. And there was a hierarchy that you explained in the grapes that go into each bottling.
There's a classification of vineyard in the Douro, which goes from letter A being the highest down to letter F being the weakest. Each vineyard in the Douro is classified by the government in terms of a point system. Now, points are given to...
Do you think it's a fair classification?
I think a very fair one. I mean, obviously, some people argue that they would like their vineyard to be letter B instead of D, but that's going to happen anyway, even in Bordeaux with the first growths and the second growths.
No doubt.
I think it's a fair system. Originally, the point system was brought in, and points are given to aspect, you know, whether you're exposed to the north wind or the how much sunshine you get, your altitude. The grapes on the highest ground are very susceptible to wind and to frost, and they tend to get a lower classification. Also, if you're in a, generally speaking, the western end of the Douro gets more rain and the yields are much lower, the productions are much higher, and you get a more diluted wine. So those vineyards down there might be letter D and E, whereas if you go up towards the eastern end of the Douro, towards the Spanish border, you get A and B quality fruit. But within our own vineyards, we have clearly there's a bit of a judgment of Solomon here between when you go to your top vineyard and say, well, am I going to make top port or am I going to make top table wine? And it's fair to say it's difficult to make both brilliant wines from the same vineyard because at some point you're going to have to select whether the great grapes go in one pot or the other. And my family has, we've put a step in both camps. We've got with the $11 wine from Douro, these are grapes that Douro doesn't need for its great vintage ports or its great LBVs. And they are, you know, good quality grapes, letter A fruit, but perhaps not the top selection.
Mm-hmm. To illustrate that point, I would say very, very good because the Douro's $11 wine at the Sommelier Challenge that we held here in San Diego in September won a gold medal. And, you know, these are people with very discerning palates and they found the wine very agreeable.
And the other end of the spectrum, you've got an estate like, for instance, Quinta de Vesuvio. This estate is an independent estate.
It's one of your famous single quintas.
Yeah, it's not attached to any of the famous brands like Graham or Douro. So we run it as a separate business. Up until now, all we've done from Vesuvio was bottle about 2,500 cases a year of vintage port. Now, this estate is able to produce about 40,000 cases. So basically, we were bottling less than 5% of the estate's production.
And what were you doing with the other grapes?
The other grapes were being made into port, and it was being sold off in bulk, made
okay,
port.
Okay, so it would be just a generic...
It was very good quality, and you know, it might go into a Graham wine or a Douro wine.
A vintage character port or something
exactly.
Like that, sure.
But we weren't putting it under the Vesuvio label. So at Vesuvio, we had the dilemma, either we could introduce, it was very difficult to make more and sell more vintage port. So rather than introduce a lesser port, we said, well, look, we're going to make a really good table wine. So at Vesuvio, we actually planted a separate vineyard about 15 years ago, which with the express intention of it only being for table wine. So we've got the very happy situation at Vesuvio today where we've got the majority of the vineyard is a port vineyard. And then we have a special vineyard for table wine. So we don't have to have that judgment of Solomon and say, well, look, half this grape has got to go into the port and half has got to go into table wine. And we can guarantee then that the table wine is going to be every bit as good as the port. So I think a lot of the top estates in the Douro, the modern style of approach to a Douro vineyard is to maximize the potential of the estate by making a little bit of port and a little bit of table wine and keeping both of them at a very high quality standard. There's a counterexample, our Quinta de Rorige, another legendary Douro estate. There we've almost dedicated 100% of production to table wines. So we're taking the vintage port quality fruit and vinifying it into a really spectacular table wine. And we've recently attached that that estate to our Criseia project that we make with Bruno Prats.
How would you describe the winemaking style, though? Is it more like Bordeaux? Is it more like California? Is it more like Spain? I mean, what type of barrels do you use? What ripeness levels do you pick the grapes? How is it similar or different from other regions that we know?
When we started off being serious about table wine, we did invite our great friend Bruno Prats from the former owner of Costa Estonel, because we really knew very little about making great red wine. We knew a lot about making great port, and we had the expertise in the vineyard. And he gave us very much the Bordeaux model, which was to ferment the wines on the skins for 10 days or more, and then transfer the wine into brand new French oak barrels. We also learned that there's a pecking order for new barrels. It's not as easy as turning up at the barrel maker and saying, I want your best barrels, because you'll find your number 129 on a list of 130 producers. But with connections, you can get up the ladder. So we've been making our top wines like Crisea.
Which is your partnership with Bruno, you know, Prats.
With a classic Bordeaux method. So we're really using almost identical methods. Obviously, the raw material.
But no international, no Bordeaux grape varieties, right?
No. Yeah. With using traditional varieties. In fact, we narrowed it down pretty much to Tarriga Nacional and Tarriga Franca as the two varietals that we prefer, that we favor in the Douro. They're complementary, and they do give a very consistent style to the wine year in, year out. In terms of the style of the wine that's made, it's very difficult to make a very Bordeaux-like wine out of grapes from the Douro, because clearly the Douro is a much hotter region. The fruit is generally riper. What we have learned is it's a good idea to go in and pick the grapes about 10 days earlier than we would for port.
For port, yeah.
It's a disaster to put grapes with any kind of raisining into table wine. One of the things we've had to learn with table wine is to control the alcohol. It's very easy to make a monstrous extracted wine, but it can be too alcoholic. It'll end up, you know, like one of those sort of...
That brings up an interesting point. You know, when I first started becoming familiar with table wines from the Douro, my expectation was that they were going to be big and jammy. And I found that it's the opposite. That they tend to have a lot of the elegance that I would find in Bordeaux. And I was surprised.
I think there's two schools of winemaking in the Douro. There are the people who are making the big monsters. This is when you extract, you know, a lot of color and flavor out of the skins in a short time. You're steeping the skins in the juice for a long time. And you do end up with these quite alcoholic, quite monstrous wines. The trouble is that they're not as easy drinking. They'll take a long time to come around. We favor really the opposite end of the spectrum, and we've actually gone as far as bleeding off juice. Obviously, when you squeeze grapes, all the color and flavor is in the skin, so you can actually remove 10% of the juice without damaging the color or the flavor of the wine.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing by that is you're concentrating it, and you're reducing some of the sugar level in the wine, so you're reducing the potential alcohol of the wine. The other way...
Do you take that juice and make rosé?
We did make a very nice rosé from our first, our Crisea 2000 runoff made a very nice rosé, but we haven't done that since.
Well, I mean, that's nice to have in a region where you really don't have white wines.
Yeah, but it was quite an alcoholic rosé.
Oh, okay.
But the other way of doing this is what's called reverse osmosis, where you remove the sugar without having to remove the liquid, which can be beneficial, because if you reduce too much liquid, you end up with an artificially concentrated wine, which is not to everyone's taste. But I think we found a nice balance, and we definitely prefer the elegant approach to Douro winemaking as opposed to the monster blockbuster wine.
Right.
Some of the critics...
And that's not to say, for example, Crisea, which we had at lunch, we had the 04, is a very concentrated, powerful wine, but it certainly has tremendous amount of structure and elegance.
One of the things I'm most proud of with Crisea is that it's not porty. Not that I don't like port. Port is in my blood.
Yeah, but, I would think.
but it's we deliberately try and manage the alcohol, so it's maybe about 13 to 13.5%. If we were to make Crisea in a port winery, which is all about rapid extraction, very quick extraction, then we'd end up with a wine that could be up to 14.5, which would be not unlike some of these big jammy Zinfandels from Central Coast, you know, which are...
Well, and, you know, I have a number of friends who are winemakers here in California, and they do a lot of lab analysis on some of the prominent California Cabernets. And even though it might say 14.5 on the label, they're pushing 17%. I mean, those are big alcoholic wines. Now, a lot of them taste good. The alcohol is nicely integrated with the oak and the fruit, and you don't necessarily feel the alcohol until... You've had about a bottle of it.
The next morning.
Yeah. So what do you think the potential is for consumer acceptance of table wines, not just from Portugal, but specifically from the Douro Valley, which has a reputation, probably the best reputation for wine in all of Portugal? What do you see as the future in the United States for those wines?
Well, it's obviously very difficult to come into the 21st century and produce a wine region out of a hat that no one's ever heard of. my ultimate dream would make to make Douro as famous as the Côte du Rhône or the Chianti, but we are a very high cost area. We can't produce grapes with our low yields and our very high production costs because
you have to use manpower.
Yes, exactly.
Because of the steep hillsides.
Very, very steep hillsides. We have to use human beings to do all the major work, the picking, the pruning. And that means that, the Douro will never be able to compete with, flatland
in Chile
or even the south of Portugal. Yeah. But we feel that the trade-off there is this, this complexity, the quality of the region will become known. And thank goodness, people are very experimental nowadays, and they're prepared to go talk to their wine merchant and say, well, what do you have for me today that's new? And I'm really pleased. I mean, in the US, we've had wine merchants have been very, very supportive. Consumers have gone out there without knowing the first thing about Douro wine. They don't even realize, some of them, that it comes from the same grapes as port. But I think it's a winning combination, marrying modern winemaking technique with old, mature, 20, 30-year-old vineyard. It's a winning combination. And, the truth lies in the bottle.
Well, I mean, just from what I know about the wine and where consumers are here in the United States, I'd say that the Dow's Bonfim at $11 and given the quality probably has unlimited potential. What about the higher end? I mean, you're really making some iconic types of red wine from the Douro Valley. Does that have potential here?
I think there's great potential. I think, you're talking, when you get up to, $50, $60, $70 a bottle, clearly it's not for some people an everyday purchase. And you're talking about a segment of the wine market, which, a lot of these top Italian producers are going for, certainly Bordeaux's going for, Burgundy, and some of the top Napa Valley names. But we're confident that at that level, the consumer is very discerning. Obviously, we have to keep the quality absolutely fantastic, but we're not going to double the production of Crisea just to try and fill a market gap.
You know, we were talking about the cost of producing one of those high-end wines, and you were making the point about its selection. So you're really kind of bringing those high-end wines down to a level in terms of, your yields and what it costs to produce that you almost have to charge those prices.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we have, I was at the harvest a couple of years ago, and we had, I counted 22 people just selecting grapes for Crisea. There was five people on a sorting trolley, basically taking out bunches prior to destemming. And then after destemming, there were people taking out individual berries and rejecting them. So there's a lot of wastage, triage along the way before the wine even gets into the tank.
Now, I've been familiar with Crisea since you introduced it and the postscriptum of Crisea. The Vesuvio was new to me. So that, where was that born and what was the idea behind it? And it seems to me that it's at the same level as Crisea.
Yes, I think, the Vesuvio obviously is a homegrown table wine, whereas Crisea is very much a partnership with the Prats family. Vesuvio, we waited, as I say, we planted new vineyard about 15 years ago with a specific intention of making table wine. Even before we'd even thought of Crisea, we were thinking about making table wines from Vesuvio. But we wanted to wait until those grapes were at least 15 years old in order to get that, that depth of complexity in the fruit. So really, it was a parallel project. It took much longer to develop, whereas Crisea came in and took fruit from our existing vineyards, our mature vineyards. It took fruit from Vesuvio, it took fruit from Bonfim, fruit from my dad's estate at Villa Velha. And it, the fruit was ready. With the Vesuvio, we wanted to wait until the vineyard was up to speed so that there would be no judgment of Solomon between, the port and the table.
Okay, so you have the Dow's Bonfim. That's your inexpensive but high quality wine. And at the top level, you have Crisea, and you have Vesuvio, and you have this Roriz.
There's a wonderful
kind of
wine
right in the middle.
Prazo de Roriz. This is a junior wine from the Roriz estate. But because we're turning all the Roriz estate into table wine, even the junior wine, and this is about $17 or so on the shelf. An amazing value, very bright, cherry-like fruit. The 2007 is the current vintage. It's a very easy-drinking wine. A little bit more serious, perhaps, than the Val de Bonfim, but still very accessible from, an everyday standpoint. Probably a little more drinkable at a young age than the Vesuvio or the Crisea, mm-hmm. but a great value.
How much are you making of these three different tiers? The Bonfim, I'm assuming you're making a substantial amount of that and bringing it into the United States, and people who would hear this could go out and find it maybe in a grocery store?
That's correct. We're making about around 6,000 dozen, so 72,000 bottles a year of the Val de Bonfim, which is, you know, pretty small by...
That's very small.
But it's big for
it's not,
us.
It's not Gallo.
Prazo, we're making around 4,000 cases.
Yeah.
The Postscriptum, we're making around 3,000 cases.
And then you get to Crisea and whatnot, and you're
Crisea, we've been around 3,000. And the Vesuvio, we made only 900 cases with our first release. So
how are you finding the wines being accepted by retailers and sommeliers and people that you're introducing it to?
Well, the good news is that, you know, our wines do have this sort of minerality, this earthiness that gives them great spirit of place. You know, there's no way you'd confuse a Douro wine with a Spanish wine or an Italian wine or a French wine. It's a very individual flavor. Mm-hmm. It's also old world. You know, I think the sommeliers are very, they love the Argentinian Malbecs and the Chilean Merlots, but they do, you know, they do love the old world. I think in terms of what I'd like to achieve, I'd like to have the same following for my Douro wines as people have for the wines of the Northern Rhone, which happen to be one of my favorite wine regions in the world. That intensity of flavor, that earthiness, and that incredible variability over the different vineyards of the Rhone. There's no uniformity in the Rhone. You get every vineyard has its own expression. I think that's very much what we're getting now.
You know, and interestingly enough, you're also talking about an area that blends many different grape varieties to achieve those different tastes depending on where the grapes are grown.
Exactly.
So anyway, I'll conclude with one last thought. You and I were chatting at lunchtime about how this wine would be accepted. And I think this is the right time for wines like this because there is a tremendous amount of curiosity by the wine consumer, especially the young wine consumer, and they don't have those old attitudes that it has to be French or it has to be Bordeaux or it has to be Burgundy. And they'll go into a wine bar and look at something on the list that they don't recognize, that they've never heard of. They don't understand what the grapes are, and they'll just try it because they're curious to try it. And I think that's going to serve you well.
I think, you know, the only thing I'd love to have some like iconic Portuguese food. Like tapas has done to Spanish wine and, you know, pasta has done to Italian wine. Portugal does have some amazing cheese. So I'm betting my money on the future of Portuguese cheese to bring people into the wine.
If we could only get some of that Runny Serra cheese here in San Diego, I would be so happy. It's one of my favorite
it's cheeses. It's Portugal's second best thing after port.
Rupert Symington, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.